than Marcus. I went to my father's old prep school, but our circumstances changed. By the time Marcus was 8, money was tighter, my father was working overseas, and I was at Oxford. Daynesford had a good record of getting boys into public school. No one knew about Aldridge's perversion. He was a sadist. He liked beating small boys, and he liked doing it in public before the assembled school. It was the ritual humiliation that Marcus couldn't take. He was timid, sensitive. He hanged himself.
It wasn't Venetia Aldridge's fault.
Of course not. Someone bears a heavy responsibility for my brother's death, but it isn't Venetia Aldridge. And as I said, we never discussed it. Private lives are best kept out of chambers.
Mr. Costello, I went to Wareham last week to see Venetia Aldridge's ex-husband and his wife Anna. Anna Cummins expected to meet Miss Aldridge at the Devereux Court entrance at 8:15 on the night of the murder. Obviously, Miss Aldridge didn't come to let her in, but while waiting, Mrs. Cummins did see a man with bright red hair. If we bring her to London, I think there's a strong possibility she'll recognise you.
Yes. I saw a woman loitering in the passage. She was there when I went in, and was still there when I came out. No doubt she'll confirm that I was only in the temple for a minute.
That's what she told me.
I went on impulse. I wanted to see Venetia. I had some important matters to discuss. Changes she might make if she became head of chambers. I knew she often worked late, but when I walked into Paulet Court and saw her light was out, it meant she'd already left, so I turned round and came out.
When you were questioned, you said you'd left chambers at 6 and that your wife could confirm you were at home all evening. And she did.
What happened was that she felt a little queasy after dinner and went to lie down. She thought I was downstairs all the time. She was mistaken. Commander, I'm a criminal lawyer. I advise my clients to answer police questions honestly, but not to volunteer information. I saw little need to confuse the issue by dwelling on my brief outing to the temple.
When Kate and I called at Janet Carpenter's flat next morning, there was no answer. Her next-door neighbour was sure she'd gone off on holiday the previous night. All the same, we borrowed the key and went in. Call it premonition, but as I pushed open the door, I knew what we'd find. Janet Carpenter, her throat cut, was lying on her back, her left leg grotesquely bent. Close to her right hand was a kitchen knife, blade and handle heavily bloodstained. Her left sleeve had been pushed up, and on the inner arm, something was written in blood. We squatted beside the body.
R.V. Beale, 1992. Beale, who raped and murdered Emily Carpenter 1 year after Aldridge got him acquitted. So Janet Carpenter killed her and then committed suicide?
That's a thought. I suppose that slit on her left wrist provided the blood for the message. I looked at her hands. Then I gently pressed the flesh at the base of the fingers on her left hand. Let's have a look at the kitchen. Come on.
What are we looking for, sir?
Anything strike you as odd?
Not really. I'd probably put the washing up liquid the other side of the sink. You think she was left-handed, sir?
Just look at her left hand. She did housework for a living, remember? You can confirm it with Miss Elkington. But if she was, then that message on the left arm couldn't have been written by her. And this is no suicide. It's murder, pure and simple.
I spoke to the next-door neighbour again, Mrs. Capstick. She confirms that she last saw Janet Carpenter yesterday night going out to post a letter. But before that, Mrs. Capstick saw her on Sunday afternoon. She was going into the church at the end of the Crescent, St. James's. Is it worth calling in, sir? I suppose there's a chance it'll be open.
A good chance, it usually is. I know the parish priest, remarkable man. They say he knows more secrets in and out of the confessional than any man in London. If he's involved in all this, we may have complications.
It's Adam Dalgleish, isn't it? It must be 6 years since we last met. It's good to see you. You're well, I hope.
Thank you, Father. May I introduce Detective Inspector Kate Miskin? I'm afraid we're here on police business.
I thought you might be. How can I help?
This picture.
I think you may have seen this woman, Mrs. Janet Carpenter, on Sunday afternoon.
Let me see. Yes, she came to confession. Why? What's happened?
We found her this morning in her sitting room with her throat cut. It's almost certainly murder.
God rest her soul.
We need any information you can give which will help us discover why she was killed and who killed her.
If I can help, of course I will. But I'd never met Mrs. Carpenter before Sunday. Everything I now know about her was told to me under the seal of the confessional. I'm sorry.
That's what I feared.
But, Father, it's murder. Surely you could tell us if she confessed to killing Venetia Aldridge. If so, we needn't waste our time looking for someone else. Mrs. Carpenter's dead. She can't care now whether you break faith with her.
My child, it isn't Janet Carpenter I'd be breaking faith with. I'm sorry. I can't reveal what she told me. But perhaps there's one way I could help. Before she left the church, Mrs. Carpenter said she'd write me a letter. She said that after I'd read it, I could do with it as I thought right, including showing it to the police. She may have changed her mind. No letter may exist. But if she did write it, and she authorizes me to pass it on to you, I'll certainly consider doing so.
Well, she was certainly seen leaving the house last night with a letter in her hand. She must have missed the last collection, so it might arrive here tomorrow. We'll come back in the morning.
Here it is. I've read it, and she's authorized me to give it to you. That poor, tortured soul.
We'll need to take it with us, I'm afraid. I'll give you a receipt.
Dear Father Prestine, I told you that my daughter-in-law, Emily's mother, committed suicide. I found it terrible to confess to you that when she died, all I felt was relief. But I don't think I could have gone on living with her grief and stayed sane. She lived every hour in the black horror of Emily's murder. I'd loved my darling granddaughter too, but for me, grief was subsumed in a terrible, all-consuming anger focused on Venetia Aldridge. If Dermot Beale hadn't been acquitted after his first trial, he couldn't have been free to kill again. But she'd defended him brilliantly. Oh, I knew she was only doing her job, but to her it was a game. She won her victories, and for her that was the end. Others had to live with the consequences, pay the price. This time I wanted her to pay. Slowly an idea took shape. Suppose a young man accused of, say, murder, was successfully defended by Venetia Aldridge, and then afterwards he seduced, perhaps even married, her daughter. That would be nemesis of a sort. To contrive this, I'd need money. The young man would have to be bribed, and with a sum he couldn't resist. And I'd need to move to London to get to know Venetia Aldridge's life. I'd have to attend as many of her trials as possible when the crime was serious and the defendant a young male. I determined to put the plan into action. I sold the house in Hereford. The mortgage was long paid off and the proceeds were substantial. I rented a small flat in London. I found a cleaning job in Middle Temple and eventually succeeded in moving to Aldrich's chambers. It all went so smoothly that if I was superstitious, I'd have believed my great revenge was preordained. For finally, in court number one at the Old Bailey, I saw Gary Ashe, and I knew my search had ended. Looking at him in the dock day after day, I sensed in him the power, the intelligence, the greed, the ruthlessness I needed. As soon as the trial ended, I wrote a letter to Ashe. I told him I had a proposal to put to him, a job that wasn't either dangerous or illegal, but for which I'd be prepared to pay £50,000 in cash. I said that if he were interested, I was waiting in the back garden.
I see you got my note.
You'd better come in. Well?
It's simple. Venetia Aldridge has a daughter, Octavia. She's just 18. I'm willing to pay you £20,000 to seduce her and another £30,000 if she agrees to marry you. You do very well out of it. She's an only child and she has money. For me, it's a matter of revenge.
Revenge comes pretty dear, doesn't it?
You could have Aldrich killed for less.
I don't want her killed. I want her to suffer.
Why?
If I didn't tell him, there'd be no bargain. So I told him everything. Dermot Beale, my granddaughter, everything. And it was settled there and then in that stinking kitchen. Two people without conscience bargaining over a body and a soul. I handed him 2,000 on the spot and said I'd pay him the rest of the money in instalments, the final payment when they were married. It didn't take him long to earn his first 20,000. He and Octavia were engaged by the time I now come to the death of Venetia Aldrich. On the night of the 9th of October, I got to Chambers at the usual time and started work. After finishing the ground floor offices, I went up to the first floor. Miss Aldrich's outer door was unlocked. The inner door was ajar and the room in darkness. I turned on the light. At first I thought she was asleep in her chair. I said, "I'm sorry." When she didn't respond to the light or to my words, I went up to her, and I could see that she was dead. But she looked perfectly peaceful. There was nothing to show that she'd been murdered. No blood, nothing. I thought it was a heart attack. And then it swept over me. She cheated me of my great revenge. All that planning, all that expense, and now she'd escaped forever. I decided on a last gesture. It was then that I fetched the blood and the wig. She deserved that final humiliation in death. Then I went out as usual. It was only when I was interviewed the next morning in Chambers that I learned that Venetia Aldrich had been murdered. That was when the enormity of what I'd done struck me. I'd conspired with evil to do evil. I, who had lost a granddaughter by murder, had put another young person into a murderer's power. That's why I came to you, Father, and made my confession. That was the first step. You said the next steps were to go to the police and to put things right with Octavia. So when Ash rings me on Tuesday morning, I'll tell him to bring Octavia to see me that evening. If he refuses, I'll go and see Octavia myself. One way or another, I'll tell her the truth. She may not believe me. She may still want to marry him, but if she does, it must be with the knowledge of what he is and what he and I together have done. And then I'll go away for a week to decide what's to be done with the rest of my life. I give you authority to show this letter to the police. I think they already know I was responsible for decorating the body, and they'll want to question me, but that can wait a week. I'll be back in 7 days. But I must have a bit of breathing space to think. Janet Carpenter.
So Ash turned up for the appointment and overpowered her when she opened the door? Or was Octavia with him? Were they in it together?
I don't think so. I doubt he'd risk committing murder in front of her. But he'll probably rely on her for an alibi.
Did Ash kill Venetia Aldrich?
Oh, no. That crime rests where we always thought, in Chambers. But now we must get round to the Aldrich house.
But they've gone, Mr. Dalgleish. Yesterday evening. Do come in.
What happened? Did they leave in a hurry?
They certainly did. It was very odd. They were down in Octavia's flat, cutting up pictures to paste on the walls. It was an idea they dreamt up from somewhere. And Ash came up to the kitchen to ask for another pair of scissors. That was at 9 o'clock. Within minutes, he was back, very angry. He said he couldn't use them. It was only then I realised I'd given him the pair Mrs. Carpenter left here, when she'd been helping out during my holiday. Mrs. Carpenter was left-handed.
What did Ash do when you told him?
That's what was so extraordinary. He went very white and stood absolutely still for a moment. Then he screamed some sort of obscenity and drove the scissors into the tabletop. He went out without another word. I heard them moving about, packing probably. About 90 minutes later, they both drove away on his motorbike.
This is it. We have to get through this wood. I'll wheel the bike. Jump off. Let's get started.
Gary, it's magical. A sea of reeds. Where are we?
These are the wetlands, the fens. See that clump of trees? No, over there.
But just behind them, there's an old house. It's on an island. You get to it over a footbridge. No one ever goes near it. That's where we're bound for. Come on, let's carry our things. I'll come back for the motorbike later. This room's dry. We'll be okay here. We'll make a fire.
I can hear the sea. It can't be far away.
About a mile. What do you think of this place?
It's secret. How did you find it?
I used to come here when I was in that children's home at Ipswich.
Were you always alone? Didn't you have a friend?
I'll go and get the bike.
Won't it be too heavy for that footbridge? Plank seemed pretty rotten to me.
I won't risk it. Watch me.
Gary!
Ah! Ah!
Are you all right?
I'm fine. I'm fine. Well, that's that, isn't it? Goodbye, Kawasaki.
Oh. But we're cut off. How are we going to get home?
Oh, we can swim for it. Then we can hitch a ride into Ipswich. We can take a train from there into London. We've got money. I'll get dry and unpack.
Mrs. Page, it's your brother, Mr. Michael Cole, we're looking for. I expect you know that Gary Ash is wanted for questioning in connection with a murder in London. We're hoping your brother may have some idea of where he's hiding. At one time, when Ash was still in care, Mr. Cole took a particular interest in him. He did his very best for the boy.
I know that. I also know how Ash repaid him. He virtually ruined my brother's career. But Michael never bore a grudge, you know. I think he liked Ash, felt sorry for him. He still does.
Where is your brother, Mrs. Page?
He's not here. We both heard about Ash on the news last night. Michael didn't say anything. In fact, he went very quiet. When I came down this morning, he'd left, on his bike.
Mrs. Page, you know your brother. Please think very hard. Where would he be likely to go? What did he and Ash enjoy doing? They'd go out on their bikes and always be back by evening. Ash liked wide open spaces and the sea. Looks to me as though Cole's gone off to some private spot known to the two of them to try a little redemption.
God help him. Well done, Kate. We'll start a helicopter search as soon as possible. We'll take a 20-mile radius from the children's home in Ipswich. I'll see you at the hotel.
Not a bad breakfast. What do you say?
Best I've ever had. Great thought, packing those tins of beans and sausage.
Why don't you go down to the water and clean the plates and things?
Okay. What'll you do?
There's a spot I used to like when I came out here as a boy. I won't be long.
Hey. Hello there.
What? Who's that? Who are you?
Get into the water with me. We'll swim across. I'll help you. Quick.
Who are you? What are you talking about?
Don't be afraid. You can do it. It's only about 30 feet. I'll help you.
Oh.
I've got a cycle up by the road. You can ride on a crossbar.
No.
We'll be in the nearest village before it's after us. You'll be cold and wet for a time, but anything's better than staying here.
You're mad. Why should I come with you? Why? Get away from me. Keep away.
Listen. Janet Carpenter's dead. Murdered. Gary Ash did it. You must come away with me. Now, please. He's dangerous.
You're lying. It isn't true. The police sent you here to trick
us. They don't know I'm here.
How did you know where to find us?
I brought him here. It was a long time ago. This was our special place.
You're Coley.
Yes, but it doesn't matter who I am. You must get away. You can't stay with him. He needs help, but you can't give it. Neither of us can.
No, no.
Coley? Well, 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 long time no see. You heard what she said. She's staying here. And so are you.
Gary, no.
Put the knife down, boy. Here, give it to me.
Come and get it, Coley. Come on. Come on, big boy. Take it off of me.
Gary, I've killed him.
It's his fault. He shouldn't have come. He should have left me alone. Come and help me shift him. He's heavier than I thought.
No, no, I can't. I won't.
Then I must do it alone. There. Hey, what are you doing?
I'm
Jane.
Come here.
You're hurting me, Gary.
I'll hurt you a lot more if you don't keep quiet. Listen. Listen to that.
Helicopter.
10 to 1, it's the police. Now, stand still here with me.
Ash, you're surrounded. There's no way out. Drop the knife and come forward with your hands in the air. Throw down the knife, Ash. Enough is enough. This isn't going to help you.
Don't be frightened, Octavia. It'll be quick and it won't hurt.
All right, Ash. What is it you want?
Nothing that you can give!
Ready? It won't hurt.
Octavia! It's all right. It's all right, Octavia. It's all over. It's all over.
Thanks for coming to see me, Kate. I thought they might have stopped you.
How are you feeling?
Better. They're sending me out tomorrow. They seem to want me to see a counsellor. Can they make me?
Of course not. But sometimes it helps.
Gary wouldn't have killed me, you know.
We couldn't take that risk.
I thought he loved me. He was as silly as thinking that Mummy loved me. Or Daddy. He's been to see me. But it wasn't any good. He doesn't want me. He loves that woman and Marie. No, I'm on my own. I'll have Mummy's money, but I can't live on that for the rest of my life. I think I'll try enrolling at some college. Take some A-levels.
I think that's a very good idea.
What about Mummy? Now you know that Mrs. Carpenter just put on the wig and poured the blood. You'll find who murdered her, won't you? You're not going to give up.
No, we won't give up. We never give up on murder.
The next day, I went for the last time to 8 Paulet Court. It was late afternoon, and as I crossed the Temple Gardens, a thin wind crept up from the river behind me. As I reached the door of chambers, Simon Costello and Drysdale Lord were coming out together.
Well met, Commander. I was just saying to Drysdale here, that was a bloody business down in the Fens.
Not pleasant, Mr. Costello, no.
I should have thought a posse of police could have arrested one man without blowing his head off. But I suppose we should be grateful. You've saved the country the expense of keeping him in prison for the next 20 years.
And the cost of you or one of your colleagues having to defend him.
Any news, Commander? You haven't come to make an arrest, I take it? Oh, no, of course not. There'll be at least 2 of you.
No, Mr. Lord, I haven't come to make an arrest. Good morning, gentlemen.
Come in, Commander. Take a seat.
Thank you.
And to what do I owe the pleasure?
Mr. Ulrich, when we last spoke in this room, we talked of your brother's death. You said someone bore a heavy responsibility, but that it wasn't Venetia Aldridge. Did you by any chance mean yourself?
That is percipient, Commander.
You were 11 years older. You were at Oxford, only a few miles away. Your parents were overseas. Did Marcus write to you about what was happening at school?
Yes, he wrote. I should have gone to the school at once, but the letter came at the wrong time. I played cricket for my college. There was a match that day and a party in London afterwards. Then 3 more days passed. I intended to go to the school as soon as I could. On the 4th day, I received a call from my uncle with the news that Marcus had killed himself.
And you destroyed Marcus's letter?
I burned it, more in panic than anything else. There was, after all, more than enough evidence against the headmaster without it. I'm puzzled, Commander. Why exactly are you here?
Because I think I know how and why Venetia Aldridge died.
But you can't prove it, is that right? Commander, what I am about to tell you is a little for your satisfaction, but more perhaps for my own. Think of it as fiction. Picture a man, successful in his career, reasonably content if not happy, but who loved only 2 people in his life. His baby brother, Marcus, and the daughter of his sister, Oh, he saw his niece, despite her beauty, growing up selfish, greedy, even a little silly. It made no difference. But perhaps you would like to go on with the story.
I think, though I've no evidence, that the niece phoned her uncle and told him that her husband's career was in jeopardy, that Venetia Aldrich was in a position to prevent him ever becoming a QC, might even destroy his career altogether. She pleaded with her uncle to use his influence to see it didn't happen. So I see him going upstairs to reason with Venetia Aldrich. It couldn't have been easy for him. I see him as a proud and private man. She was taking a phone call as he entered. He could tell it was a bad time. She'd had terrible news about her daughter, and her pleas for help from the men about her had been rejected. I think she responded to his pleas in kind. And there was something else she could throw in his face. I think it was Venetia Aldrich who posted Marcus's letter to his brother. Letters at prep school are invariably censored. How could it have got out, except with Venetia's help?
A nice touch. Let's incorporate it into our piece of fiction. What next?
Your turn.
Well, let's suppose all the emotions suppressed for so many years come to the surface. Years of guilt, disgust with himself, anger that this woman, whose family had already harmed him so much, should be planning more destruction. The paper knife was on the desk. He grabbed it and struck. He was amazed how easily the knife went in, how little blood there was. He placed the body in the chair, turned off the light, and closed the outer door. He took the knife down to the basement washroom and cleaned it thoroughly. Then he locked his briefcase in the bottom drawer of his desk and went upstairs. Slipping the knife into a filing cabinet on his way out, he went straight to the restaurant for dinner, where he'd booked his usual table to celebrate his birthday. He was there by 8:15. Does this seem to you a convincing hypothesis, Commander?
It's what I believe happened, yes.
His indignation and disgust at seeing the body the next morning was unfeigned. He did not place the wig on her head, nor did he waste his own blood.
That was Janet Carpenter.
Oh, I thought it might be. So, Commander Dalglish, we've devised a plausible solution to your problem of how a hard, cold, ruthless woman met her end. What a pity for you that it's unprovable. But don't reproach yourself, Commander.
I won't. And I hope you don't imagine that I'm closing the case. It'll remain open. If nothing else, it'll serve as a reminder that our system of law is human and therefore fallible, and that the most we can hope to achieve is a certain justice.
In A Certain Justice by P.D. James, Adam Dalglish was played by Philip Franks, Venetia Aldrich by Geraldine James, Desmond Ulrich, Kenneth Cranham, Drysdale Lord, Michael Maloney, and Simon Costello by Nicholas Bolton. Janet Carpenter was played by Susan Jameson, Octavia Aldrich by Tracy Wiles, Gary Ash by Harry Myers, Kate Miskin by Susanna Doyle, Edmund Froggatt, James Taylor, Hubert Langton, Ian Masters, Lois Costello, Sandra James Young, Mark Ralston, Richard Katz, Harry Norton, Hugh Dixon, Anna Cummings, Colleen Prendergast, Michael Cole, Damien Lynch, and Mrs. Buckley by Melinda Walker. The music was composed and performed by David Pickvance. A Certain Justice was dramatised by Neville Teller, directed by Tracy Neal, and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
There follows a Radio 4 Front Row special, first broadcast on Good Friday, the 13th of April, 2001. Mark Lawson interviews P.D. James on publication of her then-latest book, Death in Holy Orders.
Hello. In P.D. James's latest book, Death in Holy Orders, her 15th crime novel published in her 81st year, her detective, Commander Adam Dalgleish, goes to interview Father John, one of the priests at a theological college in which a murder has occurred. The novelist carefully describes the cleric's bookshelf, which holds copies of crime novels by Dorothy L. Sayers, Nia Marsh and Marjorie Allingham. This is not casual scene setting. James is offering readers a clue to her own literary ancestors by including three major women writers of the golden age of British detective fiction. But critical sleuths will also note that she omits from the shelf Agatha Christie, the previous most prominent holder of the newspaper tag which James now carries, Queen of Crime. This is because P.D. James's mission in her four decades as a published writer has been to rescue crime fiction from the reputation for bad writing which it was given by the cunning but clumsy Christie, while drawing on the tradition of psychological puzzles in closed, often rural communities established by Sayers, Marsh and Allingham. In this front row special, P.D. James talks to me about the methods, morality and psychological roots of her fiction. We began with the publication of her first novel at the age of 41. Why had she waited so relatively late, and why had she started with crime fiction?
I didn't mean to leave it so late, because I knew from early childhood that I wanted to be a novelist. But the war was not a good time. I lived in London with my husband, married young. We were bombed. And really, one needed a great deal more perseverance than I have, I think, to get started then. Then after the war, my husband came home mentally ill from war service, although it was not war service apparently that caused it. He didn't get a pension. So I needed to support him, and by then two small girls. So I needed something absolutely safe and went into the health service and then into the Home Office. But a moment came, and I was in the health service then, when I realised there was never going to be a convenient moment to begin that first novel, and that if I didn't, one day I would be saying to my grandchildren, of course I really wanted to be a writer. And if I had to speak those words, then my life would have been a failure in one very important respect. So I got started. And I think, I don't think I doubted that it was right to start with a detective story, but it was only after, really, that I persevered in the genre that I came to believe that I could in fact use the structure to say something true about men and women and about the world in which we live, and in fact aspire to be a good novelist.
When you wrote your first book, Cover Her Face, you took one of the most important bits of typing you did, more than for most writers, was when you put your name on the manuscript. Now, J.K. Rowling is routinely asked this now, and she did use the initials to disguise the gender. What about you? Why P.D. James rather than Phyllis James when you ended the book?
I'm very surprised that any woman admits to using it to conceal the gender, because as soon as the book is published, the gender is going to be known. I have a feeling, you know, that I wrote down the alternatives. I didn't for 1 minute consider that I would use my married name of White. I felt I will write under my own name, my genes, my family name. So, all right, it's James. And I think I wrote down Phyllis James, Phyllis D. James, P.D. James. And the last seemed to me by far the most attractive. And of course it was enigmatic slightly, so that was a good thing. But I don't think I felt, well, everybody will think I'm a man and that will be a great strength. Although I have to say that that sometimes they do, which surprises me, really. And I'm very glad, you know, when I've been signing a large number of books, it seems to me that it's very good to be signing P.D. James instead of Phyllis Dorothy James White, which I could have been unwise enough to use, I suppose.
There's a very powerful moment in the new book when Commander Dalgleish reflects on why he became a policeman. And he asks himself, was part of the attraction of his job the illusion it gave that death was a mystery that could be solved? And with the solution, all the unruly passions of life, all doubts and all fears could be folded away like a garment. Now, there's an obvious suspicion that that applies to being a crime novelist as well.
I think it probably does. I think it does. I think there is huge psychological satisfaction and reassurance in writing a detective story. And that is certainly one of the reasons. The other is that it distances our atavistic fear of violence and death. I'm aware myself of being very frightened of violence, whether it's violence in myself, violence in other people. I'm not, I think, afraid of death, but I'm fascinated by it. This is one way in which that is fictionalized, made into a puzzle. Then there's the satisfaction, I think, of the solution to the puzzle. If we live in an age in which it seems that some problems, mostly social and economic or international, like crime at the moment in our inner cities, that this problem is literally or seems literally beyond our ability to solve, then this is a very reassuring form of fiction. You have a puzzle at its heart. By the end of the book, you have a solution. You have order brought out of disorder. Admittedly, in the modern detective story, if it's well written, you don't have a complete restoration of peace. It's not like Dear Agatha Christie or Mayhem Parva. The justice you get is just fallible human justice, very imperfect justice, the best perhaps you can expect. It isn't the justice of God. But nevertheless, the crime is solved. And this bringing of order out of disorder, sort of making a pattern of things, yeah, I think that is psychologically very comforting.
I knew someone who worked for Faber, and they said once that they'd heard from you that you'd started a novel, and the phrase they used, which has always stuck in my head, was they said, she's found a place for the body. And place is vital to your books, isn't
absolutely
it? Whether it's London in Original Sin or in this book, as in many of the others, East Anglia, Suffolk.
Oh, yes, absolutely so. She's found a place. That is how I found a novel, when I found the place. Or rather, when the place finds me. Nearly all the detective, well, I think all of the detective stories have started with a place, with a setting, and have gone on from there to characterization, plot, clue making, denouement, all the other elements of the story.
And I have a sense of you, because in your memoirs you talk about walking a lot, of you walking around these places, East Anglia, London. Do you then, you start to get a sense of where a body might be, where a building might be? Because quite often, as in A Taste for Death, you impose on the London skyline new churches or new buildings.
Yes, I do. Yes, in A Taste for Death, the church where the whole story began was a church in Jericho in Oxford. And of course, I moved it up to London because I wanted a London novel, but it began in the vestry of that church. I was exploring it with my younger daughter. She knows I love exploring churches, and she said, you'll come and see this church. And when I was in the vestry, I could imagine those two bodies there, and I knew I had a new novel. And with Devices and Desires, I was in Suffolk and standing on this lonely stretch of beach looking out over the North Sea, thinking, you know, that I could have stood here 1,000 years ago and smelt the same sea smell, heard the same wind, seen the same wooden boats and nets drying in the wind, and then turned my eyes to the north and saw this great, terrifying, silent, stark outline of Sizewell Nuclear Power Station. And I knew I had a new book. I knew this is where it's going to be. And with this latest one, I think it was a feeling, well, I'd like a closed community. I haven't had an academic closed community, but then so many other people have set crime novels in Oxford or Cambridge or in schools. But what about a theological college? And, of course, it must be on my beloved East Coast, and the fact that the cliffs are crumbling away will be symbolic. So it was that moment when I knew I had a new book. And again, it was, I knew where the body would be.
One of the striking things about Death in Holy Orders is that a startling number of the characters are bereaved in some way, even before the murders in the narrative start. Dalgleish has always been a widower, but two of the other central characters have been widowed. There's a mother who has lost her son, all in so-called natural death. But it seemed to be very striking that the number of people who have some kind of so-called natural death in their background.
Yes, it's a very perceptive comment. And it's not only true of this book, I think. I think in many of the books. I mean, when I had Cordelia Gray, for example, as my other detective, I don't write about her now. But she was bereaved. She hadn't parents, she hadn't her father. And her lover had been killed. Many, many people. And the same with Kate Miskin, my present detective. Her grandmother's been killed. Her mother is dead. She never knew who her father was. Many of them have this trauma in their early life. I'm not sure I can altogether explain that, but it's certainly true. Perhaps it's part of my fascination with death. I don't know.
I was going to ask you about that, and you can tell me to get lost, because this goes into your life, although you have written about this in your memoirs. Mm. But the connection that is tempting to make is that you were widowed very young, and for a long time before that you'd nursed your husband who was very ill. I mean, that must have some connection with it.
I think that does have some connection with it, but I'm not sure that it's the whole explanation, because I felt this fascination. The reality of death, the finality of it, I think much younger than my age when I married, or the death of my husband. Neither of my parents died young. I really can't altogether explain this. But even if I were not a writer of detective fiction, if I were writing the so-called straight novel, I have a feeling that there'd be quite a lot of death in it. There might not be any murder, but there would be quite a lot of death.
The other connection that occurred to me, which I think must be revealing in this sense, is that you were born 2 years after the end of the First World War, so you grew up with the knowledge of a war. You then lived through the Second World War.
You know, the first thing you said, it may be the answer. It may be the answer, Mark. That's very interesting. It hadn't struck me before as an explanation. But certainly all through my very early childhood, I was aware of living in a world which was grieving. And because my father served in the First World War, and my mother had brothers who served, and she was brought up at Winchester. Her father was headmaster of the choir school there. So boys that she had known as students, as boys at the choir school, served and were lost. That sense of a grieving world, of a lost generation, was certainly part of my childhood. And, of course, Armistice Day then was very different. It took place at the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month, and literally England came to a stop. I think this may be it.
But then later on in the Second World War, you were a young mother in a London with bombs falling on it, so that must also have had an impact. And not literally.
Yes, I think it had an impact. I don't think that explains my fascination with death, but it certainly had an impact. It was an extraordinary experience to be living in London. It seems very curious now, and I think the children find it rather strange, that I didn't somehow get out of London before my younger daughter was born, but somehow I didn't. I was staying in Hampstead with friends, waiting to go into hospital, waiting for labour to begin, and she was a bit late in arriving. And I can remember we slept in the cellar. My friends had a feeling that you didn't show fear. If you didn't show fear, children didn't show fear. And they had no intention of going into any shelter themselves. But after a bit, they felt their young children ought to be downstairs in the basement, or I ought to be down there too. So there I would be lying with them, and we'd hear this incredible noise overhead, because there were anti-aircraft guns on the heath blazing away and these wretched things falling. And reading Jane Austen. What a solace. And when Jane arrived, of course, she was named after my favourite writer.
But it's probably too neat in a Freudian way, but that experience, which very few people thankfully have to have, but that you were waiting to give birth in a London where people had to expect death, didn't they? I mean, psychologically, that is an extraordinary experience.
Absolutely. They had to accept. They had to expect death. Yes, absolutely.
And the reason I was particularly interested in that is that one of the things your crime fiction does extremely well, which I think a lot of crime fiction doesn't, is you get the impact of the death. I mean, that is the hardest thing to achieve, isn't it? The sense that of the reverberations from a death among other people. Because often the person who dies in a detective novel, we scarcely know, but you have to write about the effect it has.
Yes, absolutely. And this was so, of course, in the cosy novels of the 1930s. You hardly felt it was a real death. You hardly felt it was real blood. It certainly wasn't real suffering. I don't often describe, I think only once do I describe an actual murder, and that was in Devices and Desires, and it wasn't the chief murder in the book. But I do try to describe very realistically the finding of the body, because that is tremendously important moment in the novel, and I feel the reader has to experience the horror of it and the surprise of it and the terror of it through the eyes of the person who does the discovery. And of course in Death in Holy Orders it is a very gentle priest, and to him it is appalling beyond words. In Devices and Desires it was Adam Dalgliesh, and he was interested, being an introspective man, in the difference between being called out to a scene of murder as a detective and stumbling over a murdered body. But of course he acts from the very beginning as a police officer. And that is a very different description from the description Death in Holy Orders. But it is a tremendously important moment.
And there are crime writers who claim that they've set out on a book without knowing who the murderer was, but I sense that you have to know.
Oh, I have to know. We all have our methods, and Simenon, I don't think he knew, because he tells us, you know, that he selected his character's names from the international telephone directory, and he put them into a situation, and then he let them get on with it. So he was one who didn't know. And I've spoken to writers who've said, I don't know. I must surprise myself, or I can't surprise my readers. I think very often Agatha Christie, somebody's killed in mistake for someone else, or what seems to be the unexpected victim. I seem to remember a lot of scenes in which some of the body's turned over and everybody finds it's different from the body they expected. But in most of my books, we know pretty soon who's going to be killed, largely because I set the scene before the murder takes place.
Something else you said, which is very striking in your memoirs, which seemed to be a brave thing to say, but very powerful, is the sense you and your siblings had that your parents' marriage was unhappy and would probably, in modern times, have broken up.
Yes, it might well have done. I mean, it was interesting, really. You see, it was such a different world, Mark. I went through the whole of my schooling without knowing a single child who came from a broken home. Not one. Now, there must have been unhappy marriages, and indeed my own parents' marriage was not a happy one. I don't think it would ever occur to them for a moment to divorce. It just would not have occurred to them. As one gets older and experiences more and more of life, one is able to appreciate the problems and the difficulties they faced. But children just need a great deal, I think, of love and reassurance and security. And I don't think we had much in the way of security. But that may indeed have helped to make me a writer. Mm.
Because you say many times in your memoirs and elsewhere that nothing that happens to a writer is wasted. I mean, all of it can be used.
Nothing is ever wasted that happens to a writer. No, one has to accept everything. It is all the raw material of one's art.
But I was interested in what you wrote about your parents' marriage, because one of the striking things about Adam Dalgliesh is that through all those novels, he's alone, essentially. Yes. He's a widower and he has no romantic life at all.
No, he hasn't. Actually, he does. I mean, he has a sexual life. I mean, I think my opinion is that, and I think in this book, it's sort of he's aware of this, that what he does is, and he suddenly sees that it is, that you shouldn't live like that. He is very happy to have affairs with women who are equally uncommitted. I imagine they would be fairly successful professional women who want an attractive man, both as escort and as lover, but no intention of getting married. And it suits them very well. He is a senior detective. They may not be able to see him very often because he's busy, but that's all right. And I think his poetry and his job give him an excuse, as it were, for this non-commitment. In the book, for the first time, he's just realising, I think in the words of C.P. Snow, that if you are an observer of life, it's a position of great dignity. But if you do it long enough, you lose your soul. And should he continue to be an observer? So he is, you're absolutely right, he's on his own. And none of that comes into the books. But I mean, I sort of see him as not being a celibate man, but as being a man who has no permanent attachment.
There's a notorious critical libel about women crime writers, was used particularly by Dorothy L. Sayers, that they're in love with their detective, that the detective is in some way the ideal man for them.
Well, in a way, I suppose he is. I think Dorothy L. Sayers was a little enamoured. I have a huge respect for her, both as a writer and a woman. But her emotional life was a mess, poor woman. I mean, and she didn't get the love and support either from her husband or from her son that I feel that she should have had. And certainly, I think Lord Peter did represent, at least in his later manifestations, of course, at the beginning, he's rather a sort of Bertie Wooster, silly young ass about town. But by the time we have him as a scholar monkey, standing outside the university church, discussing, I don't know, history or theology or something, you know, as the head of college, then I think he really did represent what she would like to have had in her life. I think Niall Marsh was very fond of Elaine. I'm very fond indeed of Dalgleish, so I've lived with him for very many years now. I admire him. I gave him the qualities that I admire, so I ought to admire him. But I'm not aware of being in love with him. I think this splinter of ice in the heart would be very off-putting for me, and I'd certainly hate to work for him. I'd be very nervous. I don't think he'd suffer fools gladly. I don't think I'm a fool, but I think I'd be in trouble with him before too long. But no, I do like him. I admire him, and I'm at home with him.
I was very struck by how vivid he is to you, because you talked about him, and you talked about things that he does that are not in the novels. I mean, you have that much of a sense of him as a person.
Oh, huge sense of him as a person. Huge. Yes, indeed, I have. Yes. He's very real. I don't see him very clearly, which is interesting. I don't physically see this man very clearly. And I think that's because I'm inside him all the time. And unless he looks in the looking glass, I'm not going to see him very clearly. But I was interested, how horrified I was, when someone said to me, "Are you going to kill him off?" And then I realised that would be a kind of vicarious suicide, and that, in fact, this man will die the minute I die and not a minute before.
The thing that a lot of people will pick up on in Death in Holy Orders is a strong hint that Commander Dalgleish has found love of some kind. Now, we've talked about the characterisation of him, but the question of choosing who the woman would be, you've gone for a young academic.
Yes, and between them there is an intensely strong physical and mental attraction, but it's largely hinted at. And what is interesting, really, Marcus, see, I think I'm going to have to write another book, because here we are left at the end. And I think my readers are going to say, well, come on now, you know, what happens? What happens? Do they get together permanently? Are they going to have an affair? Is he going to get married? Or is it all going to end in disaster? I don't know how it's going to end at the moment, but it's something I'm going to have to face.
Apart from being a story about murders, Death in Holy Orders, it also seemed to me partly an obituary for certain kinds of English life. But the Church of England, for example, there are various references to the sloppy grammar of the young, to the fact that IRA prisoners are being let out of jail, the Good Friday Agreement, and all of that. It's a lament in part, isn't it, for those values?
Yes, it could be seen as a lament. And of course, the sea coming in, the coastline crumbling away, the building itself threatened and obviously not going to be there for many more decades. The fact that it's going to close, the fact that it represents perhaps a view of the Church of England that is now much less popular than it ever was, for assuming it ever was popular. Yes, it can be seen as a lament, I think.
And as the title, Death in Holy Orders, suggests, the religion is a very strong theme in the book. Now, it has been in other books of yours, The Black Tower and A Taste for Death. That is partly, presumably, because of the importance of religion to you personally.
Yes, I think it's also because I am fascinated by the religious impulse in human beings. I think it's a tremendous part of our human life, this yearning that many people, perhaps one would say most, have for another reality, a sense that there is another reality, whether or not they call it God. I'm interested in different religions without, I'm afraid, being very knowledgeable about them, but I always am interested in them, interested in how people worship, how they need to worship, interested in what their beliefs are about why we're here, for heaven's sake, do we know, and what will happen to us afterwards, what we mean by living a good life. The central problem, and indeed it's a central problem, I think, for all Christians, of the belief in a God who is both good and merciful and omnipotent. The problem of a world in which there is so much pain. These problems just interest me. So it would be difficult for me, I think, to write a book in which there was no character who was religious, who had this impulse. And, of course, with Dalgleish, he has a great respect. I deliberately made him the son of a rector. And he's not a practicing Christian, but he has been left, of course, with religion in his blood. And, of course, this is set in a theological college. Here we have people who are convinced, committed Christians, both priests and ordinance. But, as Father Sebastian said, we all have darkness at the heart. There is always darkness there. And as one of the characters, Emma, says, that, you know, they may be ordinance, they may be priests, but they're still men.
But it also, it seemed to me, it suits the crime novel very well, a religious setting, because it makes the stakes much higher. I mean, for example, the famous scene in Hamlet where Hamlet can't kill Claudius, but if he does, he'll go straight to heaven. Now, there's a version of that here, isn't there? That you're writing about people, once you have characters who believe in sin, who believe in heaven, who believe in hell,
then
the stakes are much higher.
That's absolutely right.
One of the biggest questions theology is asking is, what is evil? Where does evil come from? Now, the crime novel is also addressing that question, but for you, I mean, do you believe in evil as an external force, as religion used to teach and still does in some cases, as the devil, as some kind of external figure?
I do think of it as an external force, yes. And yet, of course, I recognise, for example, that if we are considering the height of a mountain on which there is no human being and no human being has ever stood, we could not regard that as an evil place. So it does suggest that you need the human agency in order for evil to manifest itself. But I believe that evil does exist as a very potent force in the world, yes.
We talk about the importance of place to your novels, which is fundamental to them, but also professions are very important. Publishing in Original Sin, the church in Death and Holy Orders and elsewhere, the law in a certain justice. You like to have a profession to get hold of.
Oh, yes, I do very much. And, of course, it really has to be something I either know about or can learn about. The most difficult one was Devices and Desires, because the profession there, of course, if you could call it a profession, I suppose you could, running an atomic energy power station, and not being in the least bit scientific, I did a great deal of research there. But having served as a magistrate, I thought I knew something about the criminal law. And indeed, I suppose for an amateur, I know quite a lot about it, but I didn't realize how little I knew and how much I had to learn until I came to write that book. Publishing, of course, again, I felt reasonably at home in it, although that publishing house is unlike any other publishing house I've ever known. And I knew a fair amount about the church, so I felt at home with these professions.
There was a wide assumption when you were a BBC governor, it was even printed in several newspapers, that you were going to do Death of a Director General, in which, in the last case, there would have been a large number of suspects. But you never did. I was interested because that... It would seem an almost classic setting, the BBC.
Oh, indeed, yes. And one could think of several very good ideas. I think Val Gilbert didn't he at one time? Yes.
Death in Broadcasting House.
Oh, that was it, yes. I think I'd have had to work here, as apart from coming in from time to time as the governor, before I got the full measure. It's a very complex, as you know, a hugely complex organisation. But, of course, because you have soundproof rooms, there's wonderful opportunity. You could have a death on the air. A death on television, a death viewed by millions of people. I mean, there's something really rather fascinating about the idea of a death when the person will be murdered during a television programme and when everybody is seeing it, or, of course, in this studio, which is totally soundproof. So there are huge opportunities, but I've not felt somehow competent to do it. You should do it, Mark.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this programme.